we're using a very congruent, symmetrical method called SEQ, which is ease of use. And then moving forward, we've been basically saying before things ship, we want you to do ease of use too now. So you've got a prototype, test it in front of customers. If you can get it in a live environment or beta flag and test it in front of customers, you'll build your confidence in making those decisions.
My name's Isabel, and this is your Product Thinking Toolbox.
Prathana Johnson is the head of design at Atlassian with over 25 years of diverse experience. Her current role at Atlassian is leading a team across the US and Australia. Her current focus is on horizontal and Atlas product. Prathana's impressive career has also seen her hold critical positions at Shopify, SoundCloud, Microsoft, and Hubrick Limited, where she's constantly bridged marketing, brand, strategy, design, and product development to create engaging user experiences while meeting essential organizational and business metrics. I've had the personal privilege to work with her at Shopify and learn recently that she is an avid surfer, which I'm also a huge fan of. So I always love chatting with fellow surfers. Welcome to the podcast, Prathana.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Isabel. And thank you for that wonderful, not humbling intro. I sound way more impressive than I feel like I really am. Look, I'm just a down to earth, let's get some really great work done for our customers kind of person. So if you really want to rephrase everything that you just said, thank you so much. But look, I love creating products. I'm really, really lucky to be blessed to be working on something that I'm really passionate about every time I've had a job. And at the same time, I love what I do. Like, I cannot tell you or stress how much I love developing products for people, whatever capacity that you have to do it at. Like, I really am in flow equally, just like surfing, when I'm working on design of products.
I feel like you are underselling yourself, because I remember working and collaborating with you really well in Shopify, and you just had so much passion and rigor for just like being customer centric and also being so focused on moving the needle in shipping products that matter to our customers. So I feel like you're underselling yourself, but something that I want to poke on, since you're chatting about like surfing and that newfound hobby of yours, you have made some shifts since then, since we last worked together at Shopify. It's been almost like 4 years, I think, since we've last talked. How have you found your ability / your principles in balance, adaptability? I know also there's a lot of patience when it comes to surfing. Mm-hmm. How do you apply it to your career growth journey? And how do you, for example, apply that to making strategic choices or any principles of that in making career moves and navigating challenges?
I'm gonna answer two of those four areas. So surfing for me, the things that I've learned strategically and patience with surfing is, I remember, so I started surfing, I would say about 4 years ago, and out of like fluke, what coworker of mine from Turkey said, hey, let's try it. I've always wanted to try it. So I did my first class in March of 2020, pre-COVID. And so I just kind of started taking the lessons. We did a couple more, but I remember one of the instructors goes, like, push the board out of my hand, because I was so stiff. I was like trying to control the board. And he just goes, give me the board. And he goes, just chill. And that completely translates for strategy development at Atlassian or any company that I've ever been in. And I could even call it SoundCloud, a moment in reflection, or even at the startup I was at Hubrick. Patience is so critical. You might see and have premonitions of a dumpster fire. Right. You're like, oh my God, I can see it. I'm connecting the dots. I can see strategically that's not going to work. But sometimes you just need to hold tight and be patient and see how that rollout is going to be. Or when you're trying to communicate to people, you may not want to tell them everything all at once. Right. You want to just slowly, like, hey, give them a little bit of information. And I can also translate that to a pop-up. There are times when you read a wave and you look at the wave and you want to people think that you have to automatically pop up fast. And there are waves that you want to do that. But sometimes there's a wave where you actually want to go slower when you pop up. And that's reading the wave, reading people, understanding how much information that they can take and how you want to give them the right information. And that might mean that you need to shift your approach to popping up or how you communicate to those individuals as you're moving forward. So there's so many cross like references metaphorically I could do from surfing to being a strategic leader. And those two are really resonate. It's like being patient and then, you know, really reading people, I think are the two that I think is really important.
And also sometimes there is this other aspect of like building product and building good design and leading people when it comes to risk taking as well. And what you mentioned about that wave and like reading the wave, sometimes there's a little bit of risk taking involved too. How do you kind of balance that between the patience aspect of it and reading people as well?
The way that I would translate that metaphorically is, look, I think people talk about this all the time. And I think for risk taking, one of the key things I've learned is like you go out there in the surf and you do like a 1 foot wave or a 2 foot wave. And until you go out there and take a risk and do the 3 foot waves or the 4 foot waves, you aren't going to, like, sometimes you'll get more confident and more brave as you do those bigger waves to get better at the 2 foot waves. And it's like, you kind of have to step up a bit. And I do see that in decision-making and as product management, sometimes you need to take the information that you have at that point and you can't get any more information, whether it's qualitative or quantitative, to make decisions, product decisions or design decisions. And at some point you have to say, I've got to make a decision and I've got to figure out how to move forward. And even if you fall off, you have learned something that you didn't know before about that wave. And I would say that's pretty similar and in parallel to like building features, right? It's like, oh, had I not put that feature out, whether it's behind a beta flag or did a customer test or, you know, try to at least reach it out to customers and learn either from the data, I'm not going to be able to, you know if I can do it, right? Instead of hesitating, right? Hesitating to put that feature out there or over polishing the idea, overthinking it. So I think there's a bit of finding that right balance of, and you said it when we were first starting to talk before we went, is like, you know, you're like, sometimes you're out there, you're overthinking it, right? It's like, oh yeah, I got to do the pop-up right, or I got to get the wave direction, or, oh, that swell's too big or whatever. And that causes that hesitation. And that hesitation actually causes confidence challenges. And that confidence challenges means you're just not going to ride that wave. Like you might as well just like leave the water because you're not even giving it a go, right? It's like, but you get into your head a bit. So I think there's a bit of product decisions and design decisions that you can get into your head and overthink it.
Oof. And what are strategies that you use to employ when it comes to like building product to like get out of your head? I assume maybe usability testing is one of them, or some sort of testing is one of them. I know that was a leading question, but
that's all right. I mean, look, I think at some point there are decisions that you make that you just have a gut check, like, hey, you know, there's no risk, like it's a one-way door decision. Look, let's evaluate, let's do some usability studies. But then there are some like two-way door decisions, which basically like, yeah, you could do changes and updates and you probably, there's no risk, right? And so I do think, you know, it's definitely using that framework when making decisions. There's also sometimes where we over-index on overthinking, where it's like a simple button change. And I'm like, I'm sorry. Do we need to be judicious on, like, do we need to really evaluate this? Like, I think this seems like we should just ship it. There's no risk. But some of the bigger, look, Atlassian is a series of very complex products. And we've seen our competitors really be successful with what I would say easier journeys from one product to another. One thing I saw that Shopify did really well is that it is a very complex product, but if you want to create a store pretty quickly, it was pretty easy. Like about 15 minutes to 45 minutes, whether you're tech savvy or not, you could get a shop up and running and put a product up there for sale. I felt like we did a really good job at shop with those journeys in our products in the, you know, Shopify merchant size store, like back end. And I find that in our products, it's not as easy. If you're taking something like a Jira work item or issue, and you want to work in a team, and maybe that team is not managed through your admin, already you're sort of stuck. And so I do think that some of the techniques I'm using or to make decisions as a designer is to paint that picture. Is if I'm working with stakeholders, I'm working with other people, I'm really looking at how can I use my craft of design and help people see the different iterations and options for the one-way decision, which is pretty easy. Less concerned about that. That's about foundations and polish. But the more complicated, Atlassian has so many products that don't necessarily work as seamlessly as we'd like it. I can help you look at those journeys. I can use our craft to evaluate. And then we can take that work and test it with our customers, right? Just getting 10 people to come look at those flows, stack rank a capability, or walk through the journey. Is it easy to use? One of the things that we've realized across Atlassian is that we've shipped through speed, and we thought, okay, let's get this thing out the door because more features will make our customers happy and we can increase our revenue. And that's a phase of a company. There's, you know, when you're at a hyper growth company, you kind of want to ship, please your customers, and that's great. But then when you sort of scale at a certain point, you really have to reevaluate those legacy customers or the newer customers who are not familiar or didn't grow with your products. How can you make them easy to use? And they're not. And so now we're, one of the things that I'm doing, working with really closely with research, is how do we scale the practice of ease of use? And ease of use is a 7-point question, like basically a 7-factor question that allows you to ask a person, a user, and say, hey, for this task, create a team. How easy is it to do? Can you accomplish that task? And you answer from 1 to 7. And when you meet with that customer and they cannot create a team and it automatically fails, that means your ease of use of that creating a team fails, right? And you then ask them questions around, well, why did it fail? What were you expecting? And you learn so much. And unfortunately, at Atlassian, we ship so many features without doing usability tests that we've shipped things that are not easy. And so we're going back and implementing this usability practice, one, to educate people how to do it. So designers now fundamentally are required a skill set up level around usability testing. We're using a very congruent, symmetrical method called SEQ, which is ease of use. And then moving forward, we've been basically saying before things ship, we want you to do ease of use too now. So you've got a prototype, test it in front of customers. If you can get it in the live environment or beta flag and test it in front of customers, you'll build your confidence in making those decisions, right? So going back to like, how do I know that this is actually going to be a good decision? I'm actually going to put it into a live environment behind a beta flag and then get our customers to walk through the task. If they've accomplished the task and they've scored pretty well, we say about 5.5 means most customers have been able to accomplish the task with success, then, you know, it's a good experience. Then we should probably ship it. So I think we've got some really good ways of doing that at Atlassian.
So I'm curious about that program because Atlassian is clearly a huge company that many SaaS companies use, et cetera. And now you're running that program, that usability program, which is also a pretty big program, I would assume, given that there are, I also assume, many product teams. What are the kind of key takeaways you've learned from running a program like that in trying to encourage best practices, et cetera?
I'm going to explain a little bit of how we're doing it at Atlassian. One of the things we're doing is we have tied ease of use to the correlation of revenue and reduction of churn. The hypothesis is if our products are fundamentally easy to use, which we know in our CSAT studies, we have discoverability, findability, and task completion challenges, then we can be more tactical in specific features and product teams that are working on delivery of experiences to identify specific. CSAT is a bit more broad, and it's very hard to pinpoint the exact area that you need to develop. So we believe the input metric is SEQ testing, usability testing, and an output metric would be CSAT. That makes sense? So we've set this up to say, in order to increase CSAT and to reduce churn and increase revenue, we're going to identify key tasks across our products and improve the ease of use. And if we can get our scores at 5.5 or above in our live environments, that means we've shipped our products and our customers have them at hand and they score at 5.5 or above, then we know that our products are fundamentally easier to use. So this KR is two parts. One is hygiene. How do we instill how to do usability practices across the team, 550 plus? And we've set up the KR to say point three is adoption of practice across seeing them through task. If 200 tasks have been tested and they've done usability, then we have started to accomplish the first part of the rollout of the KR. The second part of the KR is the results in the roadmap. So it's pretty complicated in the sense of that I'm already learning that people, one, are scared to run SEQ in their groups because they know the capabilities are not good and they don't have time to change them and they don't have priorities to know that they can change the features. So it's like, oh, I have a business KR and I can't reprioritize my roadmap, even though the foundational element that I've on my team is not easy to use. Second is because I'm rolling out a program of work, I get a lot of questions around, well, are you the owner? And this is the fundamental like roles and responsibilities. Like, no, I do not make the decisions on whether you want to use SEQ in that feature or not, but I can help coach you on how to do that. And because it's an instrumentation, we also want to have a repository of all task scoring. So that means that, you know, it's just like instrumentation of metrics. We want people to go back and reference, oh, how did that task score? And do we need to increase it? Back in this test, it scored X. So we want to be able to have a collection of data that I can reference at any point that's always up to date. And so I'm partnering research on that. But then there's confusion because if you are on one of the teams and you are running, let's say, a feature set on team creation and team editing, I created a team in Atlassian products. I'm editing the team. I'm actually going to be the team lead. How do I do that in the product? And, you know, you are scoring, you are running a test and you are scoring. Well, where do I put the scores? Did I do the test right? How do I set up the study? How do I recruit? And there are so many like variants of how to just get that upskill up leveling. Then once I score, where do I put it so it's accessible? And so all that whole process is pretty new. So we're trying to do a lot all at once and at the same time deliver into our roadmap. So there's a lot of confusion around roles and responsibilities for research on the PM. Should a PM run an SEQ study? Right now we're saying, no, not right now, but later we will scale to other crafts. Who changes it? Do we bring in a program manager to help instill a change in the roadmap? Wait, does the researcher own the task or does the designer? So we've got a lot of roles and responsibility challenges. The other thing that I'm learning is, and this one's kind of a bigger one that's more immediate. If I practice usability studies before I ship a feature, does that qualify as still good? Or do I need to ship it into the product and run a usability study? And the reality is that you need to do both. If I have never shipped the feature and I have a prototype and I want to run it through a customer, I should probably do that so I can get a good idea if directionally my idea was valid and easy to use. But then we've shipped a bunch of things already, and or that feature didn't ship in context in a live environment, in a person's experience in with their projects, with their task and their team may be very different, whether it's the scale of their enterprise company or maybe they have a lot of data stored. So there's going to be so many things that will come into conflict to the success of that feature, depending on the scale, that you also need to do it afterwards. And so our KR is scored as live environment. And so some of us are saying, should we remove the sorry, the 0.7 scoring for a live environment.
Makes sense. I never really thought of it that way of how does usability actually tie into almost like shipping the feature and assessing value? Like we have looked at it as almost like validating assumptions and de-risking, for example, specific feature releases. But at the same time, I think that's a really good perspective of almost like a mental model of you saying, when we conduct usability studies, when we design usability studies, this is more focused on the initial kind of value or like one step towards that OKR that you want to release right. towards that specific feature, which is something that you've mentioned, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the big point is, yeah, you can get data and metrics in quant analysis, right? Like once you ship the feature, you can get an analysis of like the MAU, where people are navigating to, depending on what metrics you've got. But when you talk to a customer and you say, can you complete this task? Hey, can you create a team? And they can't, or they can, but you've talked to them and they are now giving you their perspective and their environment and how things are running. That is invaluable because it gives you ideas that are tangential. And the other, like, I know a lot of people who want to automate the SEQ studies. And I'm like, you defeats the purpose of you actually talking to customers. They want to like, oh, let's do in-product surveys. I'm like, again, that defeats the purpose of you actually talking to customers. And so I think like to connect to your question, there are a couple things. One is real customer insights are invaluable. The success rate of a customer in their environment can have many factors. And as pure as the task that you give them in their environment will give you a lot of information and how you might want to modify the feature, give you ideas for the roadmap and change it. It can work with other data as well. The quant data that you get in concert with the qual data is very invaluable. And then look, build confidence in what you're doing before you ship too, because you could remove a lot of error states before you get it out the door if you can do it beforehand, right? And so I think before and after are quite good. Before is really like you almost can put guardrails on what you ship if you do it beforehand. So if I basically have done a prototype and I've tested it with customers and I've been able to validate that it's pretty comprehensive and it's easy to use, I can probably feel more confidence in that decision-making to ship it if I have that already. And then you could be judicious and say, this feature with the high confidence of the scoring I got, we may or may not have to do it in the live environment. There are some times that you don't. You can also put guardrails and say, that didn't pass at a 5.5. So why would I even put it in the product?
This is always that age-old dilemma of, when do we decide if it's go or no go? When do we decide that it's worth iterating longer? Because sometimes there's kind of this back and forth slash dichotomy between product teams and design teams of saying, well, design spends too much time in discovery and they're not launching fast enough. But design is kind of coming back to say, well, it's not really meeting that score, for example, and we should not put that out into the market. What is the balance between that adaptation versus deciding to kill something or not even putting it out there for you?
Well, slightly different. Like, I think it's a slightly different question, but because the usability studies, you know, you're kind of already moved behind concepts. Like, you already know the concepts and I've got it in a flow and I'm at a point where we want to push that ship button. So, but the question that you have at hand, oh, I can't tell you how many times I time box things. I use a different technique altogether. And we talked about this a little bit more earlier in our conversation around decision-making. Sometimes you need to make a decision based on the information that you have today. And for designers, it's the same. You go for quantity of design ideas over a period of time, review that work, and make your best decisions with your collaborators, your PM, and your engineering, and decide on something, and then move forward. And I usually use time boxing to do that. It's like, you have, does 2 weeks sound about right for this complexity of this feature capability? And if so, let's get that and let's review it. So it's really pushing A lot of people don't like those timelines, but I just think, can we agree on the outcomes in that time frame? And we were going to make a decision. I also push a lot of decision making onto my teams. Like, can we agree that we'll get to a decision at this day? One of the things that I do is when I'm partnering with design and PM for decision making, and the designer goes off and does, hey, I need more time with discovery. I say, okay, help me understand the scope of work. What is the breakdown of design deliverables that'll get you there? Are you aiming for 50 concepts and three journeys? What is it that you're exploring? Can you break that down into deliverables and the definition of done for design? I'm doing a competitive analysis that will take me 2 weeks. I will do 100 concepts or a series of concepts in good, better, best, meaning a good solution, a better solution, and a best solution. We can review it at this time. So really breaking down what is the designer's time and deliverables, and then you can evaluate, hey, and then you can even cut things out. It's like, I understand you want to do a competitive analysis, but let's not do that. I have high confidence, so I ask you not to do that delivery. Would that create a shorter scope of time?
I love that. And I think more organizations need a framework and mental model, like what you do with your teams, because I think sometimes every team has their own way of measuring what that time boxing is or what that delivery of or incremental part of discovery looks like. So I think what you have is like a really logical part, like logical breakdown. I know we're almost at time. I do want to kind of poke into more of your experience in sitting at the table, like the bigger table, so to speak, and especially executive leadership. In many organizations, as you know, executive leadership roles have played a lack of diversity and representation, as we know. And now it's getting better. We're moving towards a more inclusive workplace. But from your experience, what are the biggest challenges you have faced when trying to get a seat at the table? And what are the biggest strategies you've employed in being able to do that?
I would say there's not one big challenge. It's a general challenge, I would say. To get the seat at the table, I know and acknowledge, unfortunately, that I do have to work harder. It takes more time to be recognized. And the way I speak as a woman, not even being, from Indian descent and visibly different than others, we communicate differently. Right. I can tell you already that I sometimes speak really fast and I get very excited. And I've worked with many men that will say, calm down, calm down. And I'm like, I'm not stressed. I'm just very excited. And this is how I talk. And I've also recognized that executive stakeholders are all human and they might be a man that needs a different working style than maybe is my natural working style to communicate more effectively with them. So whether it's diversity or equity or not, there are people culturally, gender, different, even in India, like India have different cultural norms. Men tend to dominate the conversation. Women often speak later or are asked not to break or interrupt a man talking. So for diversity, equity, and inclusion across our company, it's got to be culturally appropriate and flexible. And in my experience, I've seen that needing to flex. And I think where your flexibility isn't clear or your mindset as a leader comes in and you expect to push your culture and object and your expectations to other cultures is not ideal either. And I've seen that. So I would say some of my own challenges. I'm a mother of four. People assume that they're going to be kind to me and I can't do the amount of work because I'm a mom of four. I have seen, let me be easy on you because of that. Or they assume I've taken leave for every single one of my babies and I haven't done the time. I can say age, like I look generally young and I'm 45. I'm not afraid to say I'm 45, but generally people think I'm 30. And when they think that, that also means there's an ageism there and they assume that I've lost 15 years of experience. And I'm like, no, actually, I have quite a bit of experience. I've done a lot of really cutting edge things. So, but I don't walk in a room and go, I've got 25 years of experience. It's just people assume, having children, people assume they make, you know, calls on that. I've seen, look, in my career, I've seen people do morale events or like intentional togetherness events that are very male oriented. Hey guys, let's go to, let's do some racing on in cars. And I'm literally 6 months pregnant and I'm going, yeah, I can't participate in that. I don't feel that that's equitable. I've seen leadership teams where they're all men, every single one of them. And I didn't realize this and became quite senior. I was in a room at Microsoft and there was 11 men and me, and we were making decisions for features. And I realized, I was like, this is what I'm, am I the token person that has to make the call for this? Or are we just not looking at this this software product, which is global product at Microsoft, everybody uses it in every country. Wow, this is not a diverse group of people that are making decisions for people that, for every person that's gonna be using this product on this continent, you know what I mean? Or on many continents across the world. So I'm just surprised at how many times that's happened. I have had people, I don't like this one. This one's really hard for me. When I've had a very senior man at a company, another peer executive or very senior executive, change the way they talk to me because I am a woman and I represented design in that company at that time. They literally change their tone and direction as if I am a child and I would not understand the APIs or the engineering infrastructure capability or the business decisions. And I've seen it where they've talked to a PM and they all of a sudden go, hey, this is the technical blah, blah. Here's the API. We're going to deliver the attributes of the data need to be clean, the infrastructure, blah, blah, blah. And they switch over and they go, Prathna, well, this is going to be like this. Let me explain to you. And I'm like, did you just assume that I don't understand anything you just told that PM? Because I actually understood everything that you said. This has still happens to me today. Still happens to me today. And it can be any man, but I'm like, what? Oh my God, you just assume I don't know anything. And you just changed your whole approach with me. And while I agree, sometimes you need to have the right flex. That's been pretty, that's one of my pet peeves and biggest challenges personally. But I've seen many. I mean, I don't know if these are really good examples, but I've seen many of them in my career.
Well, I will say that everything that you've just mentioned resonates with an experience that I personally have had in the workplace, and I'm sure many others as well. So to close it out, I guess, like, what advice do you have for any designers or product leaders that are hoping to make a significant impact in their careers and have a seat at the table despite all these underlying challenges that might not be as prevalent as the past?
I know we're wrapping up. And I know I'm going to go back to a second part of that first question, and then I'll wrap up with that question. What can you do as an executive leader to make a place that's more diverse and equitable? Okay, so that's the question I want to make sure that we answer. And that answer is probably the last question and the question beforehand. First of all, I think you need to instill allyship in the company. Women are often not heard. They're often not going to speak up. They may have a different approach culturally in different cultures where women may not be told to speak up. You need allies. You need people who are facilitators in conversations. You as a leader can create a space for everyone to be equal voice in a group session over Zoom. There are different things that you can do. There is allyship, mentoring, co-partnering that you can create. You as an individual or leader can also create opportunities where you can be the voice and advocate of somebody that may be least heard or least seen. And allyship is so important. That should be through performance evaluations, through promotions, and many other approaches that you can instill with HR as counterpart. Any documentation that you have should be represented with diversity, equity in mind, particularly HR policies or policies in general. You should be looking at that across products. And there's many, many practices that you can do across the board as an entity. So definitely take a look at ways that you can instill that practice.
We don't have it perfect in software or in companies in general. You will never have it perfect. Every individual that raises a diversity, equitable, and inclusive challenge is unique. And you cannot create a generic framework to apply to each of these individuals. Every case is different and every perspective is different. The other tip I'm going to say, and very dear and dear to me through personal experiences I've had in my career, is that often we side for the senior most paid executive in the room. If a person of color and the one that's probably most diverse in diversity, in the most junior, is often not well represented or advocated for, please don't take the side of the most senior paid person in the room. Somebody needs to support that junior IC, because if they have made a complaint, they did not do it lightly. They did it with lots of curation. It took them a lot of energy to speak up to a very senior person. It took them a lot of energy to voice their point of view, and it's a very valid perspective. So please don't always side for the most senior person. Really think about how you can advocate for that most diverse, most junior person in your team, in particular, if they're voicing concerns. I can tell you right now, I am the breadwinner of my family. I am a woman and I am of color. I am hyper curated. If I speak up on diversity, it is very measured. And even as I shift my tone in this interview, I'm very serious. I'm very measured. I know exactly what I'm saying, because I know I don't want to say something that's inappropriate. I will write a message and I will curate it, edit it, spar it with somebody before I publish something, because I know I don't want to get fired because the risk is so high. So I think it's important to note that. And that would be my tip for an executive, is don't just side for the senior person in the company. You need to really evaluate that junior person. Answering my the following question, which was the number one tip. Oh gosh, that's so hard for growth. Look, I think this is going to be so simple. And I think this is maybe coming from surfing. I'm going to just tie it back up. Just chill. Can't control everything. Don't try to plan at all. Be in the moment. Be here and now. Enjoy. Read the waves. Get to know people. Have fun. If you're complaining about work and work is the only thing you're complaining about, your life is pretty darn good. Okay, so just take a moment and have a mindset shift and really recognize what is really good in your life. And focus on the hard work or the thinking or the smart work that you're doing in the work you're doing now. And even it may not be at the right level, it may not be the title that you wanted, or you've got a person that's really grumpy on your team, but or there's a stakeholder you're fearful of and you're so anxious. Just do your best work and your best thinking and enjoy it. Because I promise when you reflect on it, you will, if it was hard, you probably grew a lot. If you shift it, it was amazing. You're going to celebrate later. Just enjoy the now. Be in the moment as you are when you're in the waves and they're breaking on you and you want to ride that perfect wave. There's no perfect wave. It's all the lessons and just being out there that just enjoy that. And so I would say I'm going to leave you with that parting word, is just chill and enjoy the moment.
I love that. Let me ask you three rapid fire round questions.
Okay.
And then we can close it all off. One, longboard or shortboard?
Oh, what's my favorite board, longboard or shortboard? I'd probably say longboard, but I have a 7'6", an 8'6", and a 9'1". And depending on conditions, I'll rotate, but my favorite is the 8'6". Still a longboard.
Love that. I'm leaning towards a longboard myself these days, so I agree with that. Favorite product that you've used recently?
Interesting. I'm going to say this is basically fitness. It's not a great product. So this is going to be where it's tricky. I'm like, what's a great product that you've used? I'm using, I'll say this one. Abbott's, it's been in the news quite a bit. They just recently launched some things faster than they thought they were going to. They have a bunch of medical devices. And I think they're pioneering health and being what I would describe as knowledgeable about your body mechanics, your data around your health and bio data. I have a glucose monitor that I use periodically, not because I need it, because I'm a data nerd and I love body hacking. And they've created a insulin, like basically a glucose monitor that you can put on. And it's really skinny. It's like about, it looks like a sticker and it's just a little bit thicker, I think a couple millimeters. And then you put it, it's like a sticker that you put on your skin, but it, there is a needle in there. It's a soft needle and you put it on in behind your back and that on back of your arm. And it is pioneering. It basically reads your blood sugar pretty much periodically throughout the day. You can see how you eat your meals and what your sugar insulin levels are throughout the day. After you eat a meal, how it spikes. It gives you so much data around, oh, if I've slept and I haven't slept, how will my body respond? They do other devices. And so I'm going to say this Abbott's is really pioneering. They have the Libra 2, I think, is what they're working on. Amazing information, and they're pioneering. Is it a great usability? No. Is the apps great? No, they're broken. They need a designer. So this is where I'm like, this is a mixed answer, but I would say this is something I'm really enjoying, especially from a functionality point of view. It's pretty cool. Very pioneering.
Right. And then the third question, which is kind of a segue into that, actually, what is your favorite design product that has great design?
Oh God, this is so tricky. I mean, I really just off the cuff and really blank, unfortunately. I'm going to say Peloton, actually. Peloton. I'm going to say Peloton. Why? Because, man, that hardware is beautifully designed. When I got on the bike, I was like, wow. And what I didn't know is that the software and the UI is very beautiful. The red coloring, the branding, the spacing, the gamification from a user experience point of view, the brand itself, every instructor has got this like Peloton brand. They've really, unfortunately, they've not done well through this economic time. They've also, struggling with some lawsuits and things like that. I don't know where they are today, but I am a very big fan. They put gamification where you can high-five people. They've got animations in their UI. I literally, last night I was like, I kind of ate too much and haven't worked out today. And I just popped up my mobile phone and the app, I just launched the app on strength exercises. I think a lot of people don't know that it's not just the bike. The app itself is pretty darn good. I've done everything from outside running to strength training to boot camp classes through the tool. And I've never done a live session, but all the async things, I would say it is beautiful design. It is the details, the animations, the typography, the color usage, the brand. It is a beautiful app and it's easy to use. I picked it up and I was fairly using it pretty quickly.
I love that. As a Peloton fan myself, I agree 100%. Very impressed with your app.
Always. It is really good. And like the full screen bike, I'm like, wow. I mean, they have some things that are annoying. I'm like, oh, when I start a session, I can't find the button to cancel it because I don't have my gear on right. I'm like, dude, you did not make it easy for me to exit this thing. There's a few things that are like that, or downloading videos so you can have them in areas, because I travel so much with being nomadic with, surfing and things, or, work trips. I'm like, okay, I cannot run outside and I want to run outside, but I can't download the video, like the instructor in my ear, because I can't find it. So I think those are more power user things, but I love Peloton. Like it is like, it's well done. Well done. Even the meaning, do you know what Peloton means?
No.
It is a group of bikers that move together.
I love that.
When you think about the brand and the name, and you think about how they've done the social aspect in their app, it's like spot on. You're like, wow, this is really soup to nuts, pretty amazing.
I resonate completely. And if you're not watching the video and you're just listening in, you should see the joy and excitement that's coming on Pradhana's face. There's a lot of passion towards Peloton. Well, that being said, how can any listeners find you on your socials?
I have a blog that I do not blog. I have not blogged in 2 years. I need to put a blog up. It's called unlikelypath.com. I think it's actually a really good blog to go to anyway. It really talks about my personal experience going through different companies, different talks I've given. So that's a really great one. The second one, LinkedIn. I'm actually somebody who will respond. Isabel, you know, reached out to me on LinkedIn and said, hey, how's it going? I'm actually pretty open book. If, you know, if you reach out and you're generally wanting some value out of me and my time, I will likely give it as long as you benefit in some way. So you can reach out to me on LinkedIn. Please give it a little message around why you want to reach out to me, but I'm pretty informal. So, and I'm pretty direct and honest. So if you say, hey, I need, you know, I want to launch my own campaign and I want to use you as a test subject, I'll be like, I don't have time for that. Sorry. But if you are looking to talk or need some portfolio review or whatever it might be, I usually say yes. 90% of the time I say yes. If I have the time, I'll help you out.
You've been very gracious with your time, Pathana, like throughout just like this entire setup for this interview. So thank you again for your time. I know you're busy not only launching your usability program, but also catching those waves. So thank you again so much for your time. And
you're welcome.
Yeah, we will chat soon.
Sure.